Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Frieze Week has just wrapped up in London and the art world is nursing one big hangover. But while the temporary gallery booths are being packed up in Regent's Park, there are plenty of shows that opened last week that are still throwing open their doors for you to enjoy this autumn. One such show is called Everything at Once, a celebration of 50 years of the Listen Gallery that's been organised with the Vinyl Factory. It's located at 180 The Strand, where you might have spent some time getting square eyes at the Hayward Gallery's wonderful show, The Infinite Mix last year. It showcases big and brilliant works by many of the artists that Listen has worked with over half a century, and today we're going to meet the people who made the show and made the gallery. In the mid-60s, an art student found himself stuck at Marylebone Station after missing the last train home after a party. He bedded down on a bench on nearby Bell Street when he noticed a house for sale. This student was Nicholas Logsdale, and the building was what he would turn into the Listen Gallery. Logsdale never meant to be a gallerist. In fact, he only ever meant to put on one exhibition, but one turned into two, and two turned into half a century of presenting work by exciting artists from all over the world. This year, Listen has turned 50, and their celebratory show at 180 The Strand takes us through works by various Listen alumni, Corey Archangel, Marina Abramovich, Anish Kapoor and Susan Hillier, amongst many others. The show celebrates a diverse range of artists, disciplines and topics. As you wander the concrete corridors, video pieces sit along sculpture, while large paintings stretch between sound installations. The show opened last week and I went along to meet Nicholas and his son Alex Logsdale, who is the International Director of Listen Gallery.
Yes, I can't wait.
Of course, I had no idea it would be 50 years because I felt that I had the option to not do it at any time I wanted, which is probably one of the reasons why I continued, because I'm stubborn and I kept finding new artists who I thought were interesting. So that's the only reason, really, to go on for this long, is that you're still finding really great new artists, and you're still interested in the great ones that you're working with.
And there's something unique about the energy of the gallery, and also about the energy of this space, I suppose, Alex, that makes this something that's so different from a history lesson. It makes it feel like this gallery, despite some of the deep learning and the huge celebratory book that's come out at the same time as well to celebrate 50 years, that this all could have happened yesterday somehow. How do you get that balance right between always cocking your eye to the future and appreciating the past that you guys have had?
I think it's very much about a lineage and a history and an ethos and everything being tied together, having very similar ways of seeing the world. Would you agree with that?
What, two of us.
The two of us.
Yes.
But also the artists. That's what ties the artists all together. Even if it's not obvious in the direct practices, there's a general kind of ethos that drives them all, and it brings them together. It unites them.
How do those conversations start with new artists? You've got 50 years of them behind you now. Do those relationships still start in the same way, Nicholas?
Every relationship starts a little bit differently, but it essentially starts with a series of studio visits, sometimes over an extended period of time, and sometimes very quickly, because actually you know the work somewhat, and you know that you want to work with that artist, so you actually get down to discussing it the first or second time you visit the studio.
One thing you told me, and we've talked about, you told me very, very early on, and we talked about a lot, is something that I think maybe doesn't seem as obvious, is the personality of an artist is almost as important as their work.
Absolutely. You know, I suppose where we've had difficulties with artists, because artists can be difficult when they don't get what they want, and in a sense, my attitude has always been the artist is always right. The artist is always right. The artist is always right. And the artist is even right when they're wrong.
Very, very munificent of you.
So if they are wrong, let them find out for themselves and own up to it. Because don't forget the artist is an individual, so they're on their own. A gallery has many artists to fall back on if an artist is kind of going in the wrong direction or whatever. But to correct it is absolutely essential if you can.
But I think it's also very important to be able to have a true dialogue about the ambitions of an artist or the where they see their work historically, contextually, what they want to put out into the world and how they want it to be seen. I think that's that having that dialogue with them, because we are that platform, that's very important.
Most artists who are worth showing, or I would say all artists who are worth showing, generally have a big idea, which is an idea that's challenging historical precedents. So I would say that the historical aspect, the potential historical aspect of an artist is essential.
In terms of the right time to bring these big ideas, which is what we're talking about, to fruition, how does it feel like in the context, in the history of the gallery? You said you made a nice speech, Nicholas, earlier today here. You described yourself as an exhibitionist, which we're greatly in favour of.
Actually, when it cropped up, I didn't know what its other meaning was, and it was coming from doing a lot of exhibitions. So, and it was meant to be ironic as well.
Sorry, we didn't think you were going to flash us, it's fine. But you made the point that the artists make the gallery rather than the gallery make the artists, and that's sort of the conversation we're having. Maybe you can expand on that a little.
See, really, there's no ideal, although you aim for a certain ideal, which is a functional and productive partnership with an artist, and you're both in it together, and you share and share alike. Now, that will generally work as long as you can maintain or create the beginnings of an economy, and you grow that economy. If you can't grow the economy, there's not much you can do to help the artist, because apart from giving advice and counsel, of course, if the artist takes your advice and that turns out to be fruitful, then your relationship becomes deeper. If it goes the other way, your relationship is not going to go anywhere, really. You can say to an artist, very sincerely, I don't think you're ready for this.
I think the artists absolutely make the gallery, and one of the things that is critical is that the artists are almost entirely very admiring of each other, and that's very necessary. They have to. You're building a community, you're building a dialogue between all of these people. Their work has to coexist, and that's critical. I think that's very, very important. It's something we're very aware of.
Let's cast over the last 50 years. One of you can do this, one of you can't.
Someone told me something very funny about this the other day. I said, someone asked me about the book, and I said, well, you know, it's really all my life and most of Nicholas's. And they said, no, it's all of Nicholas's and most of your life.
It's a funny one, though, because it is a head-scratcher, isn't it? I can sense that although there's a great deal to be celebrated in 50 years, you don't really want to talk about it. You kind of want to talk about what you're doing next, don't you? It always tends to be the way. Having said that, we've got to ask the $64 million question, Nicholas. And when did you kind of realise that it was working, that this thing that you got into kind of by accident and you loved and you rocked up on your motorbike, I seem to remember, in Bell Street. When did it really click for you?
I think quite quickly. In the first year, it became very clear. The first show was meant to be the first and last show. And then I was requested by the powers that be at the Slade, in fact Sir William Coldstream, no less, that I shouldn't bother to come in anymore because I've been neglecting signing in because I was making this show. And he knew that, so he didn't think that was a good idea. And being a bit of a rebel, more than a bit of a rebel at that time, of course I was quite upset. And I thought, well, what can I do? Go on making shows. So in that first year, I thought, well, yes, this is really interesting. And it got more and more interesting as the quality of the shows got better, the quality of the audience got better, and then we started to have real collectors coming. And in a sense, it became like a Rolling Stone gathering momentum, if you like. It was the heyday of the Rolling Stone magazine as well. I think I gave myself a sort of time base of the turn of the decade, and that was going to be a decisive moment. But when we reached 1970, I didn't even think about it. I only thought about that later when I remembered that I'd set myself that time limit to make a decision about the future. And I was already completely absorbed with it, so it didn't even occur to me to make that decision. On the other hand, I think what's given me strength to go on is that I've always kept that in mind, that I could stop. You know, you don't have to do it. You only do it for as long as you feel that there's a very good reason to do it.
In terms of running the gallery, for both of you, how much of it is instinct and how much of it is knowing what you're doing?
Instinct is knowledge, but also I think if you're going along those lines, I would say I think you have to separate out running the gallery from picking, deciding which artists you work with and how you work with them from the day-to-day managing of the gallery. I mean, that's a sort of business section of the job. I mean, but the building the identity of the gallery and the group of artists is quite instinctual. It really is, and it has to be.
So the way that...
You say they're the same thing?
In a sense, the way the buildings came into use is quite similar to the way in which it works with artists, because the first set of buildings on the corner of Lisson Street and Bell Street worked out brilliantly. It started with buying one, and then buying two, and then buying three, etc. And all of that worked out great. So, you know, you have the experience of doing that, and you think, okay, no fear, we can do more of this, because it worked. And the same applies to working with artists. So you develop a way of working with them. No two galleries really work quite the same with artists. They all have different policies and ways of thinking about it. Some of them want contracts and so on and so forth. I don't think it's such a good idea generally to have contracts with artists, because they can feel very entrapped by it. And you can't necessarily tell an artist to produce work. You can try to, but they have the right to not do it. So Tony Craig said something very wonderful when I first started working with him. He gave me three works and I sold them within about 4 months. He said, that's amazing. So I better give you six next time. In a way, that's a very good metaphor for how it can work with an artist. There are other artists who just go on giving you the same number of works. When an artist's career is on fire, they supply that with work, if they're on fire. If they're not, then they just work slowly. And the production of an artist is not really related to the quality of the work or the artist themselves. You can say that they're overproducing. They're only overproducing if the work becomes boring and much too repetitive.
Pursuing one perfect artwork, the idea of making one perfect thing, which is a lot of what artists do. They're never satisfied with that last thing they made. The next one is going to be better. And that pursuit of refining and perfection is a lifelong pursuit. It's something that takes a lifetime or two.
Yeah, no, okay. So making a great work of art isn't an absolute. It is and it isn't. Because within the context of that work, a real masterpiece is looking at a work and thinking, how could it be any better? This is brilliant. And not all works are like that. They can just be interesting. They're still good. It's that brilliant breakthrough work that, of course, the museums and the collectors really look for. And it's, in a sense, we try and steer the course towards the fulfillment of the core idea from the artist. But you can't tell them what to do. They have to learn what to do through what they see happening.
I think that's a rather poetical way to end it. Thank you for talking us through 50 years, but a lot of it felt like it happened yesterday. A lot of it felt like it happened 50 years ago. I like that. That's...
Yesterday was the opening of the gallery in the first place, because that was a landmark and it was the first experience of doing something I'd never done before. And as it turns out, that has been my life so far, but I could change profession.
Thank you very much for giving us your time. Congratulations on 50 years, and thank you, Nicholas and Alex Logsdale, very much. Everything at Once is a collaboration with The Vinyl Factory, the record label and record pressing company that was responsible for the Infinite Mix with the Hayward Gallery last year, and has worked with artists such as Ranja Kjartansson and Christian Marclay on exhibitions in the past too. Creative director Sean Bidder is the man with the vision for these collaborations, and we caught up with him at the show.
Well, the building is Store Studios, 180 The Strand, and... Yeah, you were here last year for the launch of Store Studios, which was ultimately a really successful, fantastic show that a lot of people enjoyed, The Infinite Mix. While it's always very pleasing to put on such a well-received show, it does set a challenge as to what you're going to do next. It raises the bar, and one of the things we decided pretty much straight away that we wouldn't try and do was another video show about music and sound, because ultimately we would fail to live up to expectations. What we did gain from collaborating with the Hayward was a sense of scale and working with an institution that had the kind of ambition and connections to a number of artists to present a show which impacted in that way. And when Lisson approached us, were interested in working with us, we really felt that they were, even though they're a commercial gallery, they had been around long enough and had such a kind of interesting roster of artists, both historical and contemporary, that could really put on a show with us that would make a similar level of impact.
And having worked with Hayward and now with Listen and that wonderful show with Rania Kjartansson that you guys did, I guess, 3 years ago, what do you pick up from those? Because this what other parts of your practice does picking up and working with these people, a lot of good stuff must rub off on you. Tell us about those rubbed off things.
Many and varied, I guess. I suppose like most of the collaborations with the artists often start on quite a small scale, often with a record, with an idea of either we get in touch with them or somehow our paths cross. And there's an interest on the artist's behalf and on our behalf of collaborating them to produce a record, which is generally a project that everyone enjoys doing. The artists love the idea of putting a record out, whether it's their own music, whether it's soundtrack to their art. From our perspective, obviously, having a vinyl pressing plant, having a record label, it enables us to do that. And I suppose we offer them a really good opportunity to be creative with that format. I mean, you know, they can kind of dream up to a large extent what they want to do. And then we develop a relationship. I mean, hopefully it's a good one. People get on, they have fun, they enjoy the process. And then often from that is a springboard for us to do bigger and better things. And with some of the artists you've mentioned, whether it's Ragnar, we have a record label with Ragnar, and you know, he's a pretty fun guy. You know, he's an entertaining chap, got a good sense of humour, and he's got great ideas, and he's ambitious with those ideas. And I think like a lot of what we find inspiring working with a lot of artists is they don't have the kind of same boundaries as other people, and the way they approach making music or the way they approach film is always different from a conventional commercial kind of approach. So that's exciting. And then hopefully with a bit of our experience and our nous and our teams, we're able to kind of shape that into things that people want to see.
Holly and I were talking about this earlier, and saying when you get an email or you get invited to something at the Vinyl Factory, you literally never know what you're going to get, which is a great thing. And is that something, do you have to think about what you were doing 3 or 4 years ago in order not to do it again? Or is it just like, right, okay, it seems like a project where you will jump in sort of both feet first?
That's good to hear in a way, because I think it's always exciting if you don't have a sort of stereotypical impression of what someone's going to do. But I think fundamentally for Vinyl Factory, the projects do have a kind of core which applies to all of them, really, which is this connection between art and music and how the two intertwine. And whether it's a record or whether it's a kind of, you know, a big immersive installation, there is a sense that there's a continuity there. So that's those two things coming together. How we've evolved that to the point we're at now, really, is we're now commissioning work on a larger scale. So we've always done that with records, but now we're working with artists to actually produce new site-specific works, many of which will be showcased here at Store Studios, some of which start their journey somewhere else. I mean, there's a piece that opened last week with a video director called Khalil Joseph, who people will probably know from directing Beyonce and Kendrick Lamar and other people in that vein, but also hopefully if they came to the Infinite Mix from the amazing film that he showed here last year, MAAD, which was set in Compton and was a visual portrait of that city. And he, you know, we've continued that collaboration with Khalil, and we've produced his new film, which is shot in Harlem, so it's the other part of the country, but again with an incredible musical soundtrack. And that's just debuted at the New Museum in New York, and it will be coming here next year. And these commissions are collaborations with the store, which is the entity which which is kind of representing the building here, and their Store X Vinyl Factory commission, so new works. And we've got a lot of hopefully exciting things in the pipeline to come next year as well.
Of course, this exhibition couldn't have come together without some careful planning and curation. And the man with the plan is Listen Gallery's head of content and regular voice on Monocle 24, Ossian Ward. He's also been looking after the publication of a beautifully bound and very large book that details the past 50 years of Listen, called Artist, Work, Listen. Ossian's been a busy guy, but he took 10 minutes out to tell us about the anniversary celebrations.
Well, I mean, we've all been to big group shows where the title means absolutely nothing. So I thought, why not just put it out there? I think the idea that you can fit either the history of a gallery like the Listen Gallery into 50 years and 150 artists into one show is ridiculous. So how better to explain that than, I mean, you know, we did try. It's a big show. There's over 40 works by 25 artists. So it takes a while to get through it. Everything at once is impossible. But it was also because this John Cage quote, everything happens at once, it came from 1966, 67. So it's a 50-year-old quote. And we like to think, because of our screens and our manic lifestyles and our social media accounts, that everything happens at once. But that's what they were thinking about in the 60s, especially people like Cage and Marshall McLuhan. So the theory was then that art was experiential. It was happening to you from all angles. It was assaulting all your senses. And that was true 50 years ago.
How do you start something like that? I mean, you're working on a book at the same time, the 50 years, which has come out, a handsome volume. Congratulations on that as well. Did one lead to the other? Did doing the book help you put this show together? Because there's so many conversations you have to have with Alex and Nicholas at the gallery, presumably with the artists themselves. How does all that stuff sort of come to fruition?
Well, it was easy in the way that we decided that the book should be the history and the exhibition. Well, because we can't fit everything in at once, the book would do that. So the book should have been called Everything at Once, and the show should have been called Artist Work Listen. I got it the wrong way around. It's a small typo. I'll get over it. It's fine. No, the history is all in the book. So that was... It's also a kind of weirdly pretentious conceptual book in that it's all the artists from A through to Z. It's not really about the gallery. It's about the artists that have shown. There are little interjections from Nicholas and Alex and Greg at each stage, so each letter, artists, beginnings, context, there's a little theme. So the book kind of filled itself up in a way, you know, that each artist had their own archival material. We have postcards from Sol LeWitt and letters from all the artists. So the show had to be something very different, very dynamic, not looking backwards. Nicholas himself, although he's got good anecdotes, doesn't generally like to wallow in nostalgia. He doesn't see the value in these things. I'm thinking, wow, look at all these documents. They're amazing. People find that interesting. And he's never been sure. He's never done a 20th, a 30th, a 40th book. He just didn't want to do it. And I had to force him to do it in a way. But it's the 50th year, so we did it. The show is very different. It was also the Vinyl Factory wanted to do something with us. And their view on art is this immersive, everything hits you at once kind of way of looking at art. And we can do that. But we thought, well, they did a good job of that with the Infinite Mix and the Haywood Gallery, these video pieces and these booths and boxes that you walked into. So why not show some painting and sculpture and break out a bit?
Yeah, it's strange that can seem radical in a space like this, right?
Exactly, yeah. And actually the painting has to be good to stand up to the spaces because they're boxy, they're concrete, and you're walking, you know, yards and yards, and then you come across a painting. How's that going to stand up? So we do have this amazing Richard Long wall drawing, mud painting, which he did with his hands in a few hours on the Sunday. And that fills almost 60 meters of wall. Not bad for a 72-year-old man. Similarly with Stanley Whitney, his paintings kind of, you know, they're very vibrant. They do hold their own, but the spaces are difficult. Then there's a Dan Graham downstairs that looks like the space it's in. It's all glass and steel, reflects to you, reflects office architecture. Similarly with Julian Opie upstairs. We wanted to play with the building, and the Vinyl Factory like that. They want to show off their space. It's difficult, it's awkward, it's in the middle of town, but it's spectacular. You've got views here over to the Thames, so we played a bit with that, and these Tony Cragg towers that look a little bit like skyscrapers, and Tatsuo's Time Waterfall with the floating numbers, which look a bit like they could be floating down into the Thames. So there was lots of fun to be had here. It's just you can't get it all in. So obviously we left some artists out, but some artists' work maybe didn't compete with the building. You know, I wanted to show all the archival material, but putting little objects like that into a big building like this, it eats people and it eats work. So you've got to be strong.
I asked Nicholas and Alex about whether the artists make the gallery or the gallery make the artists, and they said, and you won't be surprised to hear that they said that the artists make the gallery. But you've curated this show, you've been a writer and art historian, you know what 50 years of this gallery means in a different way to what they do. What is that vibe as you see it, and now being part of it, what is the vibe of the Listen Gallery that you've helped to curate and put on show here over those 50 years?
Well, I'm going to ask you, did they like the show? That's what's worrying me now. You've had this long conversation with them, and I don't even know if they like the show. No, I think the idea is that some people have this idea that Listen's very conceptual, very rigorous. They showed Donald Judd, Sol LeWitt. It was all hard-edged, you know, really difficult, serious work. And actually, over the years, that's changed. And yes, they showed a lot of New Yorkers and a lot of British artists. Anish Kapoor came through the gallery. But now you look at it and there's all kinds of people there. So they're right. The artists have made the gallery and they've changed the gallery throughout the years. there are a few people, there are sort of spines that run throughout. There's a guy called Peter Joseph that's shown with the gallery since 1967, but apart from that, it hasn't stuck to the same thing. Nicholas always looks forward, he doesn't look backwards, so that's difficult to encompass. So I employed this designer, Irma Boom, who's an amazing Dutch designer, very, very famous, and she helped me come up with this concept where the book was, you know, seemingly kind of formed out of this alphabetical, mad organizational system. And that sort of fits the listen, you know, it's very listen. People keep telling me that. I'm like, what does that mean?
Is that by accident or by design on your behalf? Because it does look like something that could have been part of their oeuvre in the 60s or 70s.
It's got that retro 1970s conceptual art book feel, and indeed the paper's very thin, so we like to say you can kind of see the past and the future through the paper. And Nicholas likes a bit of humour. If I made this book and there was no... The last picture in the whole book is one of Nicholas's sons in his baby buggy, and his baby buggy's got stripes on it. The stripes are basically like the Daniel Baren show that the buggy's parked in. And we've never printed it before because I don't know what Danielle would make of it, but it's a bit of humour. You know, there's moments in the show as well, you know, Rodney Graham and other artists. It's funny. What we're trying not to do is say this is a listen show, you know, it's all about the listen. The Vinyl Factory, not only have they handsomely helped us with the space by, you know, giving us the space, they've helped with the curation of the show, so we want to celebrate their shows as well. And we've also got, I mean, Haroon Mears has got an amazing show at 176, Zabludovic, John Okomfor is about to unveil this new however many screen work at the Barbican, which I haven't even seen. I imagine that's going to be amazing. So it's not about sort of just brand listen. It's the 50th anniversary. So, yeah, we'll do that. But I kind of can stop talking about it now. Hooray.
Let's get out and about. Ossian Ward, as ever, thank you very much.
Cheers. Bye.
Ossian Ward there, bringing us to the end of today's show. Everything at Once is on at 180 The Strand until the 10th of December. And you can find out more about the book and all other Listen exhibitions at listengallery.com. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was Holly, the infinite mistress, Fisher. Tune in at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.